Welcome everyone to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Today we are very excited to have Mike Jones here to actually present the demonstrating proof of possession at the application layer, DPOP, today. But before we get to the main agenda, I just want to quickly go over the admin stuff. So first of all, just a quick reminder on the code of ethics and professional conduct. Just want to make sure that everyone make respectful comments and acknowledge each other's opinions. A quick IP note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So if you have any questions on that or have any encounter any issues creating the W3C account, please feel free to reach out to any of the co-chairs. A quick call note, all the calls are being automatically recorded and transcribed, and we will publish the meeting minutes and audio recordings within the next few days. We use GG Chat to queue the speakers during the call, as well as to take minutes. So you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue or Q- to remove. All right, any introductions or reintroductions? If you're new to the community or if you haven't been engaging with the community and wants to re-engage, please feel free to unmute. Right, toward the end, if we got time and you don't feel as shy, feel free to just unmute and introduce yourself. All right, next, announcements and reminders. Any news? Any new announcements or reminders? A quick preview of what's coming. So next week, we'll have the special W3C CCG hybrid open house session at the Internet Identity Workshop at 12 p.m. Because again, 9 a.m. we have the open circle, so it will be a special meeting at 12 p.m. Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time. And then the week after that, we will talk about selective disclosure mechanisms, an overview of different selective disclosure mechanisms out there. And then the week after that, we'll talk about the Grant Negotiation Authorization Protocol, GNAP. And then after that, we'll talk about mobile driver license. All right, any other announcements or reminders? Any updates to the work items? All right, pretty simple. I think most people are here to learn more about the DPOP from Mike. So that I think, Mike, we don't need further introductions. I think you have been a legend in our space. So the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. So I will introduce myself. I'm Mike Jones. I spent a number of years at Microsoft doing identity standards work. And I'm now an independent consultant still doing identity standards and ecosystem building work. I've worked on OAuth, OpenID Connect, the JSON Web Token, W3C Web Crypto, the DID spec, and verifiable credentials, among other things. So I'm here to talk to you today about enabling proof of possession in a practical way, which has been something that's been an elusive goal for the industry for a long time. And I'll give the caveat. This started as a deck that I gave at Identiverse a year ago, hence the slide template. I have updated the content to reflect the current reality. But I didn't bother updating the template because it was hard. So this was a presentation that Identiverse I gave with my colleague Peter Castleman. So, in the next 20 minutes, I have 20 minutes, correct?
Actually, it can be 30 minutes or 40 minutes, and we'll do the Q&A afterwards.
Okay.
But either way, it's fine.
I will talk about how token theft is a real problem that affects the industry and the security of the systems that we actually use. Proof of possession is a way to mitigate the token theft, and talk about some attacks that Depop explicitly mitigates. So this is data from a year ago, but over a 6-month period, the identity protection team at Microsoft detected over 150,000 token thefts and over 1.7 million device malware infections. This came from my friend Alex Weiner, the head of identity protection at Microsoft. The token thefts are typically bearer tokens. A bearer token is like cash. If you have it, you can use it, even if you stole it. So the theft of bearer tokens became a significant problem. So proof of possession tokens are a safer alternative. Proof of possession or POP token is like your driver's license. Only you can use it. And the reason that only you can use it is it's bound to you in some demonstrable way. On the driver's license, the photo is the binding to you. In proof of possession tokens, a cryptographic key is the way you bind the token. So the use of bearer tokens was defined by RFC 6750, essentially a decade ago, more than a decade ago now. And before Depop, there was no OAuth 2.0 standard for proof of possession tokens. So what is proof of possession? Proof of possession demonstrates possession of a cryptographic key material when performing an operation. It does that by signing something using a private key, and only the possessor of the private key can use a leaked or stolen token, even if it's stolen. So the industry has taken a bunch of stabs at this problem, and it's used a whole bunch of different names. I give this survey of names just so if you've heard of this under other names that you'll realize, oh, this is the same thing. So it's been called proof of possession, holder of key, which is the SAML terminology, sender-constrained tokens, key-constrained tokens, certificate-bound tokens, key-bound tokens, key confirmation, etc. And as I mentioned, the industry has taken a bunch of stabs at this. To its credit, SAML 2.0 has the holder of key assertion profile, which is a bound token, although it's not exactly OAuth, which was the problem space that we're trying to solve for. OAuth 1 used proof of possession, but the message signing that went with it was too complicated for most developers to get right. There was an OAuth 2 Mac draft, which was a lot like OAuth 1. That got abandoned. There was an HTTP 2 signing draft. That also got abandoned. There was the TLS token binding set of RFCs, which could have worked, but some browsers declined to ship it. OAuth 2.0 Mutual TLS does work, and it's used in some closed environments successfully, where closed environments might be payment ecosystems or open banking systems where all the parties are known to a central authority and they can be issued a client certificate by that authority, as opposed to open systems where people would be issuing their own certificates. Which brings us to the topic for today, the OAuth 2 DPOP, the demonstration of proof of possession spec, which is our current stab at solving this important problem. So what is DPOP? It stands for demonstrating proof of possession, which happens at the application layer. And as of last month, it became an RFC. Yay. RFC 9449. A symmetric number. Now, it's a pragmatic way for applications to do proof of possession as opposed to it happening at sort of a system service level. Now, what's in a name? It's at least humorous to me to note that DPOP started out because Brian Campbell was in the S-Bahn in Stuttgart and saw this poster for Deutsche Pop, which is a education program in German for the arts. And he thought, oh, okay, Pop, that's proof of possession. Deutsche Pop, that's DPOP. We should find a way to do a reverse acronym for Deutsche Pop. And so that's the actual origin of the name. So how does it work? DPOP sends a JSON web token for the proof of possession as an HTTP header. So it demonstrates proof of possession in the context of the request. And it's sent in the same way both for token requests and protected resource requests. The authorization server uses the proof to bind the tokens, and the resource server uses the proof to verify the bound tokens. And the figure there is straight out of the spec. So, what does a DPOP proof look like? For those of you who know JSON Web Tokens, a lot of this should be familiar. So, there's an explicit type so that you can't confuse the DPOP proof with another kind of JOT. There's an algorithm. There's a key, which is used to verify the proof of possession. There's a token identifier for replay protection. There's the HTTP method, which in this case is POST. There's the URL where the thing came from. There's when it was issued. There's a hash of the access token, so that can't be substituted. And there's a nonce provided by the server to prevent certain kinds of attacks, which we'll talk about. And so there's an access token request. But instead of using the type bearer, it's using the type DPOP. And there's an access token response. Again, rather than using the token type bearer, you're getting a DPOP token. And you can do a refresh token request to bind the refresh token to the DPOP key. So you include a DPOP header in the refresh token request. Likewise, if you're doing a protected resource request, you can DPOP bind that. And Now, there's this thing in HTTP that some of you are probably familiar with called the WWW Authenticate Challenge. That's a means for a server to say to the requester, oh, you need to do this in order to satisfy me. And so there's a DPOP WWW Authenticate Challenge defined to say, you have to use DPOP. And by the way, these are the signature algorithms that I support. And so a response to a protected resource request with an invalid token might be 401 unauthorized and say that you need to have DPOP. And then you retry with the DPOP token. So originally the DPOP spec was simpler than the final version. And while I love simplicity, I also love security. There were a couple features that were added because in early versions of the spec as deployed, there were a couple attacks that could still be mounted, where you could mint DPOP tokens by a bad actor. So one of these is mitigated by a server-provided nonce, a value that the server creates, to put in the DPOP proof. That way the server can know that, oh, well, this is a DPOP proof that's current at this server because the server provided content put into the proof. So there is metadata associated with this. As those of you who know OAuth know that there's both authorization server metadata. In this case, there's metadata saying what signing algorithms you support. And there's client registration metadata, where the client can say, only send me DPOP tokens. I will not accept bearer tokens. So it's possible to bind the authorization code, not just the access tokens and the refresh tokens, to a DPOP key. This was something that was added later in the specification development, which enables end-to-end binding of the whole flow. Those of you who know OAuth 2 will recall that for the code flow and some of the other flows, there's a request to the authorization server that returns an authorization code followed by a request to the token endpoint. Originally, DPOP only worked at the token endpoint. This extends DPOP to also work at the authorization endpoint. So we got an RFC last month. Yay. Here is another picture of Brian Campbell finding another Deutsche Pop sign, this time in Vienna, in the U-Bahn, again, the German subways, which he found auspicious because this was the same day that DPOP was moved to working group last call. So we have a standard. That's great. Adoption is never a certainty. You know, individual developers and organizations have to decide to build it. In some very high volume services, people worry about the cost of asymmetric cryptography. Some proposals had been made by Amazon and the like to also enable use of symmetric cryptography, but that requires a key exchange step, which isn't in the spec. It was eventually decided by the working group that if we wanted a symmetric version of DPOP, it would be a new spec. So far, nobody has written that. That said, I mean, Depop is being used in production in some real environments. For one thing, the financial grade API 2.0 draft, which is used as a basis for a lot of open banking and open finance deployments around the world, does use Depop. There's certification tests that include Depop tests. Now I'll really get down into the details about two potential attacks that caused us to add features that I've talked about. So attack one is pre-computing a proof. So Depop has this structure. There's an identity provider, a client, and a resource server, where the identity provider is an authorization server. So you present a public key and proof of possession to the identity provider. You bind the client to the cryptographic keys and the tokens. You get back a sender constrained or a Depop bound access token and maybe refresh token. The client generates fresh Depop proofs with an issued at parameter to guarantee freshness. The client sends the fresh proof of possession with the access token to the resource. The resource accepts the token if the proof of possession is valid, and the access is granted. That's sort of the basic Depop flow. But let's look at a pre-computation attack. So you start off the same as normal, but if there's malware in the client, the client has, and the malware has access to the key material, or at least the ability to sign with the key material to generate Depop proofs. And a clever malware client could generate proofs well into the future. It could, you know, create a proof for now. It could create a proof for a minute from now. It could create a proof for 10 minutes from now. It could create a proof for an hour from now. And then it can take those proofs, pull them off the box, and take them to a place under control of the attacker. Time passes, and then the attacker can use those pre-computed proofs at the resource, and the resource doesn't have any way to know that these weren't generated by the real client or by the intended party. And guess what? The attacker gets resource access, even though he's off box. So how do we fix that? Well, you start off as normal. The malware is present. He pre-computes some proofs. He takes the proofs off box. Time passes. He presents them. But the difference is the server has provided a nonce, a value of its choosing, to put into the proofs. And so that value was provided before the proofs were computed. And guess what? If the server has updated the nonce value, then when the Depop proof is examined, if the nonce value isn't current, people will know that something's amiss. And so you're able to prevent that attack by using a server-provided nonce. Again, this is a common pattern in security protocols, that if you want freshness, you need to have one party contribute material to the cryptographically signed entity so that that party can know, oh, this is something that I authorized. The next attack is rebinding the authorization code. So here's our standard diagram again. So remember, OAuth usually uses two endpoints, the authorization endpoint and the token endpoint. This steps back and breaks out the authorization endpoint request as opposed to the token endpoint request. So you authenticate the user and issue the authorization code. That goes back to the client. The client then contacts the token endpoint using the public key and the DPOP proof. And the authorization server binds the client-controlled keys to the tokens. You send back the sender-constrained token. Client generates proofs. You present the proofs. RP accepts the tokens if the proof of possession is valid, and you get access. So that's all great. But, you know, what if there's a proxy or a VPN in the middle, for instance? The access codes and other artifacts end up in log files. And I'm not making this up. This really does happen. So supposing the attacker somehow gets some access to your servers and can pull the authorization code out of a log file, then with that authorization code, the attacker can generate its own DPOP key and DPOP proofs that are not actually owned by the client. And so the attacker can start using tokens obtained with the authorization code and goes to town. So how do we prevent that? And I mentioned this earlier, but let's go over it. You start off as normal. The attacker gets the authorization code, generates its own proofs, etc. But the authorization server compares the DPOP JSON web key with the presented public key and rejects the request if they don't match. Again, the reason they won't match is the attacker doesn't have the client's key. It was using its own key. But by DPOP binding the authorization code and not just the access token, you can, again, end-to-end bind the whole flow. So any good talk has a call for action. The call for action here is protect yourself from token theft using DPOP. Implement it, deploy it. We hope that's done the job. That's my capsule summary of DPOP in 20 minutes. I would now be glad to take questions from any of you fine people.
All right, Dimitri.
And a question. No, I just want to say that, Mike, I want to give a big thanks and a big shout out to you on all your work on the DPOP spec, because it is what has enabled the solid authentication spec to exist. This is a Tim Berners-Lee solid project, with a personal data server and so on, and it's cross-domain authentication system uses the DPOP spec at its heart. So, big thanks. You've enabled an entire community to exist with it.
Cool. Well, thank you for letting me know that Solid is using it.
Any other questions? Oh, wait, Mike. I'm just curious. You mentioned that there had been quite a bit of other attempts previously to DPOP. So what's different between DPOP solution versus the previous solutions, and what do you think is different this time that you think DPOP has a higher chance of getting adopted?
Well, let's get back to that slide. Oops. Build slides, going back through them takes a while. Alrighty. So the short answer is we think we've hit a workable balance between complexity and security. You know, developers are finicky people. They don't want to do more than they have to and don't want to do things that they don't fundamentally understand. So let's walk through this list. So SAML 2 did have a holder, or does have a holder of key assertion profile, and it is used in some deployments. So that's actually a success story, although SAML 2 has its own set of complexities, the most notable being that signing a SAML token requires XML canonicalization. And one of the big takeaways from XML desig and XML canonicalization is that it's too hard and developers got it wrong. And so all the solutions after that require no canonicalization. So OAuth 1 did have proof of possession, but it required signing HTTP requests in a fairly general way, and it had a lot of options. There were options for whether to sign the HTTP body or not. There were options to say which header parameters were, or which HTTP headers were signed. And, you know, the signing required, again, our bugaboo canonicalization of some of the fields. And evidence was that different developers, when trying to implement it, would implement it slightly differently. And cryptographic functions have this step function that either they totally work or they don't work at all. If you have a difference, for instance, between a carriage return line feed and a carriage return or a line feed, it means the signatures don't match. And so while OAuth 1 could have worked, there were other problems with it, but I'll just focus on that one. A lot of developers in practice at the time, which is over a decade ago, thought this is too hard. We will develop something simpler called OAuth Wrap, where Wrap stood for Web Resource Authorization Protocol. And you'll notice in the ITF that the name of the working group is officially the Web Resource Authorization Protocol Working Group. That developed what became OAuth 2. I stepped into the mix at about that time. And the main editor at the time, Aaron Hammer-Lahav, didn't believe in bearer tokens, and yet that's what Google and Microsoft and Salesforce and Facebook and others wanted to deploy. And so I became the editor of the bearer token spec, and Aaron did the Mac spec, which eventually got abandoned because the working group wasn't that interested in it. Justin Richard did an HTTP signing draft, but again, it was at least as complex as the OAuth 1 signing. And the working group abandoned it due to complexity. As a side note, I will say that the HTTP working group did eventually try to do a general HTTP signing draft, and that became an RFC, but that happened in parallel with DPOP. You know, perhaps if it existed before Depop existed, we would have done a profile of the HTTP signing. But as it is, we sign basically two things, the method, like post, and the request URL, as was shown in one of the diagrams. Now, let's talk about TLS token binding. That was something where you could do cryptographic binding for a TLS session, so a connection between here and there, and bind the messages sent over TLS to cryptographic material maintained by the TLS engine. And there was a draft for doing binding of HTTP requests over TLS token binding. And there was an OAuth draft to use that HTTP binding. And there was the OpenID Connect draft to do that TLS token binding. This was one of the strange twists in this long and winding road, that we got to the place where those specs were done, essentially. They went to the RFC editor. They were deployed in Chrome and Edge and, I believe, Firefox. And I can't remember the status of Safari. And some friends in the Chrome team decided, oh, this is going to be too hard to maintain. We're going to rip it out. And they ripped it out of Chrome on the day that it went to the RFC editor. And like a lot of these things, these solutions only work if they're ubiquitous. If it, you know, is browser dependent and it works in Safari but doesn't work in Chrome, you're SOL. And so that was a good start. We learned a lot from it. It's not deployed. Now, Mutual TLS is kind of an old technology. I mean, there's been ways of using TLS client certificates for most of the time that TLS has existed. The problem is that client certificate management is hard. And if you involve the end user at all, they will get it wrong. It can only really work well in closed ecosystems like banking ecosystems, where all the parties are able to be centrally administered and you can push the client certificates from a central authority to all the participants. So that can work, and it does work, but it doesn't work in open systems environments, which is why we eventually got to the Depop idea, which started at an OAuth security workshop 4 years ago, where we were brainstorming, okay, well, what can we do if we're not going to have token binding? And if it's not going to be at the TLS or the operating system layer, we're going to have to do it at the application level. What can we do at the application level that will work? And this is a long preface to me answering the question, which is, why do I think this is going to work? I think it's going to work because developers can build it and deploy it themselves in their protocol stacks without having to get browser support or operating system support, whereas TLS token binding actually needed both. You had to have support in the TLS stack, which sometimes was in the operating system, and you had to have support to pipe that up through the HTTP layers. So for instance, to implement this in Java, you had to have a modified version of the Java virtual machine that piped this additional parameter up through the sockets layer. I mean, Brian Campbell and others had built such support, but Oracle had never committed to ship it. And then the whole thing came crashing down, where you can use Depop just by building both ends of it and using it. So I think we're on a path to incremental adoption that's going to work. And it's also the case that because this uses OAuth discovery, you can incrementally figure out whether the endpoint you're talking to supports it or not. If it supports it, use it. If it doesn't support it, use the bearer tokens you've been using for a decade.
Thank you. That's a very detailed answer. Thanks a lot. So in any sense, this is like a decentralized approach to that's not dependent on like centralized authorities like browser platforms and things like that, basically, right?
Exactly. It's in the hands of developers rather than in the hands of having to have a central authority for the ecosystem you're talking to.
Cool. Thanks. And what are the future work like that's involved, or you think this, I mean, this solution sounds like pretty much done, but I'm just curious, like, what are the future developments?
The future work is implementing and deploying it, and related work is calling for its use in specifications where it's appropriate. So Dimitri called out that Solid is using it. I called out that FAPI 2.0 is using it. There's going to be a lot of other specifications and ecosystems that decide to use it. So again, the work is no longer specification work for the mechanism. The work is using it.
Got it. And what are the main challenges in adoption? I think you mentioned about computational complexity due to the asymmetric encryptions and things like that. Are there other challenges?
The main challenges, I think, are that for it to work, you have to have all the parties participating in the exchange support it. So OAuth has a three-party model. It has the client, it has an authorization server, and it has the protected resource. And for Depop to work, all of them have to be aware of it and use it. If one of the parties doesn't participate, it doesn't work. And so, like, you know, building out any new ecosystem feature, you have to get everybody to sign up to play for it to actually work. Now, the good news, as I said before, is you can do this incrementally. Through discovery, you can see, does my authorization server support Depop tokens at all? And if so, you ask for them. If not, you use bearer tokens.
Got it. Thank you. Dimitri?
Yeah, I wanted to answer your question from the implementer side on what are the challenges of it. And it's the challenge we constantly have in this group, which is key management, right? Client side key management, which, you know, Depop requires to work. That's the whole point of Depop. It presents a developer education challenge, it's a shift it's a paradigm shift for developers, right? So the main thing that's difficult is the key management, but like, you know, that's what we do here day in and day out.
Let me add something about key management that we didn't do in this talk, which is the Depop key can be in a secured element. So if you're on a mobile phone with a secure enclave, if you're on a PC or a Mac with a TPM, you can put the Depop keys in a place that they cannot be exfiltrated. This is a higher security bar than you get by having just software managed keys. In particular, if it's in a secure element or a TPM, you can't go somewhere else and get Depop signatures because the private key stays in the device and there's no way to extract it. Now, there's a performance cost to that, and it varies by secured key method. I know that TPM digital signatures are not fast. Some of the secured elements on mobile phones are faster. And so you're better off, even against malware, if you can put the key in a secure element of some form. Whereas if your key is just managed in software and you have malware, it's likely that the malware is able to extract the private key.
Kat, you're next in the queue.
Just another implementation note. From the perspective of a user, all the open link stuff that is relevant is or will be implementing Depop as we go. We did it first in regards to our solid support, but it'll get further.
Thanks, Ted. Can you, in a sentence or two, tell me what OpenLink is?
OpenLink Software is the database company behind Virtuoso, which is the engine that powers DBpedia, Py2RDF, Uniprot, and about, well, I'll say most of the nodes that you find on the Log Cloud graphic.
Thanks, Ted.
Cool. Any other questions or comments?
I'll give a shout out to Brian Campbell, who's on the call, who was one of the key inventors and participated in the slog of taking a draft from an individual draft to an RFC. I don't know if you want to add anything, Brian.
No, but thank you for the acknowledgement.
Thank you, Brian. And thanks for hopping on as well. All right. So thanks, Brian. Thanks, Mike. Thanks for taking the time to come to CCG here today to present Depop. It's a very interesting talk. Hope I learned quite a bit today. So hope everyone else do the same as well. All right. Any last items that people want to bring up, whether it's introductions, reintroductions, announcements, reminders that we didn't get to earlier in the meeting? Cool. I think this concludes this week's W3C CCG meeting. Have a good one. Bye.
All right. Thank you for inviting me, and go forth and protect your tokens.
Thanks, Mike. And thanks for the call to action. Thanks for the CTA.
See y'all. Bye.